Good afternoon, everyone. I know we don't have near a quorum yet. However, we want to get started today to convene this meeting. We have no minutes, so we can begin. I'm Representative Patty Fritz, and I will be convening the hearing today. Today, we will have an opportunity to learn about the funding streams for our disabled community long-term care funding that's available to all of them. So we're going to start today with those folks. We have, first of all, we're going to have the people with disabilities come to the microphone, please, and introduce yourselves for the tape, and we'll get started. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Cheetah from Courage Center. We are also a member organization of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities and have been for many years, as are my colleagues to my immediate left, and I will have them introduce themselves when it is their turn to speak. My role in this presentation is to give you an introduction to the one piece of paper before you, and I hope that you all have copies of the handout that we have prepared. It's entitled Accessing the Disability Service System. There is a logo for the Minnesota Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities in the upper right-hand corner. It was modeled after a similar sheet that you saw last week during the presentation by those discussing the state mental health system, and we're told that that was helpful to members in describing the system, which I would argue isn't much of a system at all, but a fragmented collection of products, services, providers, and options for people depending on their category of eligibility, not necessarily their level of need. The population that we're talking about today, so to look at the first three boxes at the top of the page, causes, onset, and types. There are multiple causes for disability, and you can see what those reasons are there. To make it really short, it's something you're either born with or it's something that you acquire by factor of birth or genetic makeup, or if it's an accident or illness, or just natural parts of the aging progression. You're either born with a disability or you acquire one, and that difference in and of itself creates very different doors for eligibility for different programs that may be available to you through government-funded programs and services. Rules are very different, as we know, for children as compared to adults, and Henry will speak to some of the challenges and rules that apply to both childhood and adults. So we're talking about a very widely varied population, different types of disabilities, different needs, different levels of complexity, as different as a child who may be born with cerebral palsy, someone with co-occurring chronic conditions in the adult population, diabetes, congestive heart failure, asthma, or any combination of those, and widely varied needs and services based on those needs, depending on a variety of factors. Also want to make the case that much of what you heard last week regarding the mental health system, many of the individuals that we're talking about today will also interact with that system. The presentations that follow today from the county and from the long-term care and aging community, individuals with disabilities also access many of those services, and in some cases many of those institutions, nursing homes, as a good example, we still have about 2,500 individuals who are not elderly who are living in nursing homes today. A large percentage of those individuals have both a physical disability and a co-occurring mental health condition. So these categories, while helpful in determining eligibility for programs and better understanding the service needs, they are certainly not mutually exclusive. If we think very briefly about the elements of success, or the domain areas that we all need in order to be successful in our everyday lives, I would break those down into four categories. One being economic self-sufficiency. For many of us, that's a job. Health, broadly defined, not just medical services, but other health services, preventive services that we may access. Housing, just a basic need for shelter. And finally, transportation. And I mentioned each of those four areas because if you dig into the details of the budget purview of this committee, you will find all of them. A large percentage of dollars spent on housing, medical transportation, certainly income supports for individuals with disabilities, as well as a medical assistance buy-in program to employ individuals with disabilities. So we aren't just talking traditional medical services or traditional healthcare services when we talk about the needs of this population. I think I will leave it at that, Madam Chair, and turn it over to Ann Hendricks.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. And we represent children and adults across the state with long-term significant disabilities. My part of the presentation is the next section entitled Health Coverage in the middle of that first page, if you want to look at those boxes. Certainly, a lot of people with disabilities have private coverage, or at least start out that way. They have it either through employment, they might have individual coverage, or they're the dependent of someone with coverage, a spouse or a child of parents who have coverage. But if the person has significant functional limitations due to their disability, they find out soon enough that their private coverage really underinsures them for the needs that they have. If you skip over the large box in the middle of the page to underinsured, you can see the list of some of the kinds of things that people can't really get as needed with a long-term disability, such as rehabilitation services, for instance, physical therapy, if you need therapy to maintain your functioning, habilitative services, durable medical equipment, wheelchairs, augmentative communication devices, medical supplies, certainly help at home. If you need help to function in your home and the community, you really can't get that on an ongoing basis in private coverage. So when people get to the point that private coverage does not meet their needs, they really have only one option, and that is to seek medical assistance coverage. Medical assistance, and this is really important to remember in the scheme of things, medical assistance is really the only benefit set that provides ongoing community support services. And one of the problems with medical assistance is that as the only option, people really are left with no option but qualifying for a low-income program. We still require people to impoverish themselves because of their health condition if they need community support such as a personal care assistant or home and community waivers. We do have one program that John mentioned, medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, and that is a wonderful option. People can have their income, pay a premium, and still keep some assets up to $20,000. But we only have 7,200 people out of 99,000 people in Minnesota with medical assistance due to disabilities. So by and large, most people who need these services have to impoverish themselves. The road then to getting medical assistance is really in the middle box, and it's different for children and adults. And before I describe some of the complexity of this, let me just step back and reflect on the fact that Medicaid is a state-federal partnership. The federal government will match the dollars that we spend.
on health care, but they'll only do it for three eligible groups: low-income children and families, people with disabilities, and seniors over 65. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about those three groups for a moment, for children in low-income families, you can tell age, income, assets, those are known quantities, and you can apply. Same true for seniors. You can tell age, income, assets, you can apply. But if you need medical assistance because you have a disability, that gets to be a mighty complicated process because you have to qualify under Social Security disability standards. So people either go to the Social Security Administration and apply, and certainly people who have worked and are covered by Social Security would do that because they need the income support as well.
Yes, Sammy, I'm just going to hold it for just a minute, please. I'm going to call the meeting to order. We now have a quorum, so we're officially on record. I'm sorry to interrupt. Continue.
No problem. Thank you. So people would, if they are not going to seek Social Security benefits because they don't have a work history, they could seek to meet the standards of Social Security, those disability criteria, through our state medical review team. And that also is a process based on disability. The state medical review team is supposed to use the same standards as the Social Security Administration. It's a five-step sequential process. We won't go into that detail now. But you can tell that it's a time-consuming process. You have to provide medical records. You have to be reviewed. It isn't the same as proving that you're low income and you're a certain age. So if you're a child, you have to meet the Social Security standards under the SSI program, Supplemental Security Income. And you can either, again, do that by Social Security itself, the administration, or state medical review team. And you, while waiting for that, you could just be a low-income child in medical assistance. So you find children with disabilities in our TMAP programs because they have not yet gone through the disability determination process. If you are a child in a family that is not low income, in other words, your parents are above the low income standards, you still can qualify for medical assistance if you meet a higher bar. You have to both meet Social Security disability standards of the SSI program, and you have to meet the level of care of an institution, a hospital, a nursing facility, an ICFMR, or a Children's Mental Health Rule 5 residential treatment program. So you've got two criteria to meet in order to qualify for medical assistance TEFRA. And then, as many of you know from constituents, the family has to pay that parent's fee in order to qualify for services. And again, let me just connect this back. These are children whose employer, the family's employer-based coverage does not cover the services they need due to their disability. So the only option they have is to qualify for medical assistance as best they can. We also find that some of these children might be in families on Minnesota Care if they haven't gone through the disability process. Some families use Minnesota Comprehensive Health Insurance, their high-risk pool. And some try to get some assistance from Mission or Services for Children with Special Health Needs at the health department, although that's mainly information and training and assistance to get coverage. Let me turn now to adults. Again, if you are an adult who has an adult onset of disability, you probably are going to go through Social Security if you qualify because you'll need that income. But if you also need medical assistance services because Medicare is not enough, and again, Medicare really is much like the employer coverage that we have on the market. It covers acute care and it'll cover post-hospital home care and so on. But Medicare also does not cover ongoing assistance once you've reached your baseline and you need help to live in the community. You can get determined disabled as an adult through Social Security or, again, through the state medical review team. And just as a side note here, my colleagues at Legal Aid have represented a lot of people trying to get through the SMRT process, as it's called, state medical review team. And we do have some suggestions on making that program more efficient because we find that people, while they're waiting for this disability process, are getting general assistance medical care, paid for by the state, or MinnesotaCare, again, state dollars. But really, they are disabled, and they could qualify. And there's no reason that we should have a lengthy, inefficient process for those folks. So we've got people then waiting to get qualified for Social Security. Even after they get qualified as disabled through Social Security, they have a 2-year waiting period for Medicare to pick up their hospital, doctor, and so on costs. Hopefully that will change. It's a federal issue, however. So a lot of those folks have to qualify for medical assistance. And what we see here, and you, I'm sure, again, have heard about this from some constituents, is people have to spend down their Social Security income to qualify for medical assistance. Because our medical assistance program, if you're over 100% of poverty as an adult with disabilities, you have to spend down to 75% of poverty, which is now $650 a month. And a lot of people get Social Security above $867 a month, I think the 100% level is now. So they have to spend all that. That's a large out-of-pocket percent of your income for health care if you have a disability. Again, if you don't go through the Social Security process, you go through the state medical review team, which uses the same criteria. But while you're waiting, you could be on general assistance medical care, you could be on MinnesotaCare, you could be in the EMSA program or high-risk pool, and you also could be on MA if you're a parent of low-income children. So that is an effort, at least, to give you the picture of how complicated it can be for people to qualify as disabled in order to get really the only benefits that exist to meet their ongoing community needs. And so I will, with that, turn it over to Steve Larson. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota and also co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And I talked to a couple of the members of the committee before this meeting. I just want to clarify a couple of things. One, Representative Scalzi asked me if there was going to be a test on this stuff after the committee hearing. And yes, there will be, Representative Scalzi, but it will be an open book test. And in order to help you, I tried to copy a document today, but we have a brand new printer and we ran out of ink, so I couldn't. I'm sure when the Department of Human Services did their sessions with you, they might have referenced or shared with you a document called Continuing Care Matrix, which is available online, easily accessible. And it contains information about many of the programs that I will be talking about. And I'm not going to go into details in this document, but it has the cost, the number of people on the program, that sort of thing. So it's a great tool, Representative Scalzi. When the test occurs, you'll be able to use that for open book. Representative Scalzi is my legislator, so I'll give her a little trouble. And then I have one more question, Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me. Does Representative Abler have a stop sign today, or?
Madam Chair? There were so many reports yesterday about how bad they feel treated. They just have a whole new chair, so I make it better.
Well, I stopped twice yesterday by Representative Abler and then at the town meeting last night. So, anyway, we're going to go to the just to the right side of the front page there and just cover a few more issues. But when we start hitting down on the box that says service needs, I just wrote in there, get a life services. And that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about just health services when we're talking about persons with disabilities. But many of the programs you're going to hear about today, both in this presentation and the following presentation, will be how people utilize the supports that are provided through the state and federal government in order to support them to be included in their communities as working citizens. And that, and many of these services are very important to that. And so we have a list there of many of the important components of helping a person get a life, and starting with basic care and the importance of preventative services and how we can avoid some more greater expenses in the future if we don't prevent things currently. Durable medical equipment, which is very important to many of the people that we represent, as well as habilitation, rehabilitation, and a lot of these things have been talked about during this legislative session already. And part of that Get a Life Services, of course, is supporting a person to live in their place of their home that they choose. And that would include living in their own home, living in their apartment, living in a group home. It includes accessing employment, which is an important thing that we think we can strive to make great improvements in for persons with disabilities, personal health, monitoring, those sorts of things. So now I'm going to turn over to the backside. and the title there for providers. And I think John and Ann both emphasized that many of the programs that are referenced here do not serve just one population, but many of them serve all of the populations of persons with disabilities, whether it's a person with autism, whether it's a person with cerebral palsy, whether it's a person with mental health needs. These programs, in many instances, serve all of those individuals. And so that's true of home health care. It's true of home care personal care assistance, which serves all populations. It's true of the waiver program. Some of those waiver programs are specialty programs, like the developmental disabilities waiver or the TDI waiver. But the CADI and CAC waiver serves persons with a variety of disabilities. In fact, there is some of the greatest growth in the CADI waiver, of which I think there's close to 15,000 people on that waiver right now, is serving individuals with that have a primary diagnosis of mental illness. And the reason that that's happening is because the state has, in the past few years, emphasized getting people out of institutions and supporting them in the community. And so there's been planned growth in the CADI waiver. We have employment and day support programs such as day training and rehabilitation, and the list of programs there. And one of the most cost-beneficial programs the state ever created was the semi-independent living services, which allows persons with disability to live in the community with approximately 5 to 10 hours support a day. And those are state-funded programs that hasn't really grown in 20 years, but has been very cost-effective in keeping people in the community. Then we have our state-operated programs that provide many of the same types of services that I listed above, and for those individuals that have needs and that another provider cannot be found for. Individuals with disabilities also access all of the health providers that we have here. It was interesting to listen to the dental discussion yesterday or the day before, talking about the specialty needs for dental services, and I certainly was interested in what Dr. Sulik had to say, but there are certainly dentists throughout the state that provide comparable services for individuals with disabilities, and we need to make sure that dental care is available for individuals. Then on the right-hand side, we have the institutional models of care, nursing facilities, as John said. Just a reminder, there's 2,500 people, 165, residing in nursing homes. For the past several years, it's been major initiatives to get those individuals out of nursing homes, and we've put together the support plans for those individuals or the support services, but either through caps in those programs or a greatly significant problem is the lack of housing for persons with disabilities. We've not been as successful in getting people under 65 out of nursing homes as we'd like to be. There's approximately 2,000 people still in ICFMR programs, and certainly individuals with disabilities access hospitals across the state. The public or state-funded programs provide comparable and sometimes different services that are listed there. Ann has covered many of the things. I'm going to go down to funding on the left-hand side, and she's outlined many of those programs there, but I think just to emphasize the complexity of this, if you're a family and you have a child born with disabilities and you look at the documents that we have here and you have those multiple choices, just think how difficult that is. So as we look into the future, we need to make sure that people are getting the support to work their way through the system. And I'll get back to case management in just a minute and talk about that. The service delivery options, there's some very innovative things that have occurred in the last 10 years in Minnesota. Consumer-directed community supports, the Minnesota Disability Health Options, which takes a holistic look at persons with disabilities to help meet their needs. Special needs basic care, which became available to individuals with disabilities in the past year or so, and intensive care coordination, etc. Consumer-directed community supports is one item I want to spend just a minute on, because I don't know about the rest of you, but I received an email the other night saying that we're supposed to get all of our innovative ideas to the committee so that they can look at them as we move into the future here. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to emphasize again consumer-directed community support. I think every Minnesotan with disabilities that is on one of the programs that we've identified here should know what their individual budget is before the end of the year so that they can plan with their support manager, case manager, or whatever we're going to call that person in the future. Figure out what that individual budget is and how they're going to spend it, get it approved by the county or whatever other administrative entity has to do with that. Align themselves with a fiscal support entity which will help them utilize their budget and account for those dollars down to every penny. and then utilize that money to find the flexible support to support them in the most inclusive environment that they can have. And I think this program should be expanded. We have 2,000 Minnesotans on it right now, and I think we would be much more cost-effectively spending our state dollars if we moved into that type of services and made it available for individuals. This is not only for persons with disabilities, but there's also persons, older Minnesotans, are also on this program. So we'll continue to talk about that, and we do have legislation that Representative Fritz has initiated, and we have a comparable bill in the Senate that will help temporarily fix it. But actually, the Compass program, which we haven't referred to yet, when that's fully implemented, will make it even easier for us to implement consumer-directed community supports across all of our programs. Other supports and funding, county case management. I'm looking forward to the county presentation today, but case management is in great flux. And what I mean by that is because of the funding sources being much more difficult and federal dollars not coming in, caseloads are rising. We would like to see support brokers or support managers available to individuals, work with the counties on administrative case management where they would oversee the budgets and quality assurance and move in that direction, but have a hands-on or a person that understands what the needs of the individual with disabilities are and can advise them through this whole system we have here and come up with a support plan. And we need to move to that, and there are national models available that we can look at, and we had a great report that came out about 18 months ago that Department of Human Services had that has the blueprint for moving in that type of direction. And then persons with disabilities obviously benefit from all of the other programs here, and I'm just going to highlight the last one, K-12 education. The most important thing we can do in this area is make sure that persons, students with disabilities are included in their schools to the maximum possible. When they become adults, we're going to expect them to work. And so they need to build relationships in school, get their support. We need to use those school years to make sure that we're identifying what their educational needs are, if they need assistance in communicating, get that taken care of, get the training done so that they can become productive adults that are fully involved and included in their community. And so with that, I think we'll take questions. And I think we have a minute or so left, Representative Abler, for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Larson. And are there any questions for these three folks at this time? I do not see any. But I do want to thank you all, to all three of you, for your passion and dedication to this area. Thank you so much. And we're going to...
Sir?
Yes.
Can they bank that minute for later use?
Certainly. Today, members, I do want to have you join me in welcoming the Health Auxiliary of Minnesota in the audience. Welcome to the committee, all of you. We're going to move on then. We're going to change, have a little change up in our testifiers. We will now go to the Services for Long-Term Care. If you'd come up to the table, please, and join us. Welcome to the committee, and if you would go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, please, and proceed. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gail Kvenfold. I'm the president of Aging Services of Minnesota, formerly known as the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. We're a membership association whose members are providers across the state of Minnesota. I'm here today representing the Long-Term Care Imperative, which is a collaboration between ourselves and Care Providers of Minnesota. I'm going to be the first of three speakers, and then I believe Dawn Simonson is going to follow us, and we can come back for questions if there's time.
Very good. Thank you.
We know that you face an extremely difficult time in balancing the budget for this next biennium, and we know that it will require shared sacrifice by all. But as you grapple with this immediate crisis, we would urge that you preserve as much as possible the reform we've made in Minnesota in long-term care service delivery and use as guideposts for your decision-making the key elements of the vision that is shared by consumers and providers alike. And that is that older people live in a place they call home for as long as possible,
that consumers and their families are empowered to make informed choices that provide them with the right care at the right time in the right place, that caregiving is an honored and sought-after profession, and that quality, accountability, effectiveness, and innovation are the hallmarks of our service delivery. In your packets, you'll find a set of PowerPoint slides under the name of the Long-Term Care Imperative. They highlight some of the major trends in service delivery and issues of the day. I won't speak to each of them nor review each one of them, but rather use just a few minutes to highlight some of the key points that may be useful to you as background for your decision-making. First of all, we can be proud of our commitment to and progress in keeping people at home as long as possible. It's what older people want, and it's prudent stewardship of our public dollar. We've been leaders in expanding the options for older adults in our state and in communities both large and small. Our policies have encouraged home and community-based services and congregate housing options, while reserving nursing homes for those who need that special kind of 24-hour care most. You have a slide in your packet that shows that we now have twice as many housing with services options in the state of Minnesota as we have care center beds. And that's my second point. There has also been dramatic change in the nursing home arena, or as we call them, care centers. We have fewer of them, and they are smaller than they have been before. They have more private rooms. They're increasingly organized around care delivery models that represent, recognize resident control and decision-making. And probably most importantly, we use nursing homes very differently than we did in the past, as places where we stay an ever shorter length of time, often for rehab, and then return to the community. Yet even as we mark these important changes, we must note the challenges that they present for the staff we need in today's care centers, the skills they must possess, and the quality that we must preserve. Third, sometimes the focus on the nature of the services that we provide and the projections about the needs that we represent in terms of health and human services spending obscures the increasingly vital role that we play in this state's economy. And especially in these times, it seems critical to point out that we're a powerful force for economic stability and recovery in our state. The total impact of the state's care centers, assisted living, and residential care facilities is more than $9.8 billion, and that doesn't take into account the home and community-based services that we provide. Our providers support more than 142,000 jobs, and in many communities, we are among the largest, if not the largest, employer. In care centers, about 70% of the state and federal and private dollars that flow through our facilities in the form of our rates goes directly to the people we employ, and they turn around and spend those dollars for goods and supplies in the community. Finally, there is a saying going around healthcare reform these days that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And in that spirit, we would also urge that in these challenging times, we take up the bigger question of long-term care financing reform. You know, as we know, that beyond this biennium, we face unprecedented growth in the number of older Minnesotans. We know we have to find a new way of paying for the services that our parents and our grandfathers and ourselves as baby boomers are going to need, and we hope that this session we can take a closer look at what some of those options might be. We have identified a handful of principles we hope will frame action and discussion, and we are watching very closely some legislation that has already been introduced in these areas. But those principles for financing reform are leveraging our own personal responsibilities to help plan for and finance the care and services we might need, sustaining and extending the informal support of families and neighbors and communities, pooling risk across broader populations, stimulating and increasing the role of private long-term care insurance, and finally our hope that we could reposition Medicaid as a true safety net and not the vehicle for financing most of our state's long-term care. We stand ready to work with you on this new frontier of financing reform, as well as the more immediate challenges that we have in serving Minnesotans, older Minnesotans today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And, sir, please.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Kevin Mendick. I'm the president of the United Steelworkers Local 9460 out of Duluth, Minnesota. I represent nearly 3,000 members who are healthcare workers in hospitals, clinics, long-term care, and assisted living settings. I address you today on behalf of the Seniors and Workers for Quality, a coalition in which the United Steelworkers are proud members and whose mission is to improve the quality of long-term care for those who depend on it and those who provide it. In particular, I'll be referring to the direct care workforce, the certified nursing assistants, home health care aides, personal care, and day service attendants, who are the front lines in the care and support for older people and persons with disabilities. Quality care and quality jobs are inseparable. For the past 10 years, our coalition has advocated for public policies that improve the recruitment, education, retention, recognition, and support of direct care workers. The governor's long-term care budget proposals for 2009 are the very antithesis of these policies. Today, these workers are nearly universally working in short and understaffed environments, risking injuries to their clients and themselves. With $10 million in proposed cutbacks to nursing homes alone for the next biennium, the gap between advocacy and reality will deepen. Meanwhile, home and community-based services, acknowledged as the future of long-term care, will lose $84 million in the next 2 years under the governor's budget. Home and community services are where the need for trained workers is rapidly growing and the labor pool is not. Cutbacks in client eligibility through the level of care revisions and through limits on disability waivers growth compound the problem. Staffing is fundamental to the safety of vulnerable adults in any care setting. A workforce of part-time, short-term, and poorly supported people who are forced by circumstances to work at breakneck speed with highly dependent people is a recipe for tragedy. Meanwhile, the governor's budget fails to recognize how wise investments in elder care and disability services are not only humane, but make much better economic sense. Direct care jobs have an impact on local communities and their economies. When direct care workers are laid off or their hours cut, their businesses lose out. Instead of buying power, what too many direct care workers have is a household that now qualifies for public benefits like medical assistance or food stamps. We need to ask ourselves, why don't we rather invest in adequate wages and benefits instead of accepting the meager compensation that will ultimately be subsidized elsewhere in our public budget? Without trusted, consistent direct care workers, employed family givers are often forced out of their own jobs or down to part-time work to manage the care of their loved ones. The cost of turnover in long-term care staff are wasted dollars in the medical assistance and Medicare program. Using CD's turnover survey for the American Healthcare Association, Hollis Turnham a few years ago calculated that Minnesota spent $54 million on turnover, 30,200 certified nursing assistants with a 51% turnover rate, and $3,500 direct and indirect costs per individual leaving the job. Especially alarming is the highest turnover rate is in the first 90 days because people are unprepared technically or emotionally for the demands of the job. We're wasting precious dollars on a turnstile of hiring, quick training, changing schedules and assignments, inadequate support and supervision, and limited peer support. For more data on the economic impact of short-sighted long-term care funding, I'd recommend a series of issue briefs done by the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute, notably the Elder Care Disability Services, Untapped Engine for Job Creation and Economic Growth, published in November 2008. I thank you, Madam Chair and members, for your attention and for the commitment to long-term care that serves the needs of vulnerable adults and the people who care for them.
I thank you, Mr. Endick. Very, very nice. Any questions, members? Okay, let's go to our next testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Michelle Kimball. I'm the state director for AARP here in Minnesota, representing more than 700,000 Minnesotans and their families over the age of 50. These are the very people that are served by the members represented by my colleagues here today. Every family across our state touches the long-term care system in some way. Thousands have loved ones residing in facilities and even more care for elders at home. Others are currently helping a sick parent, neighbor, or relative search for a nursing home, assisted living facility, or home care aid. And still others are looking ahead to their own future and trying to plan. And if they aren't planning, they should be. Even in a time of economic or fiscal crisis, Minnesota's consumers, taxpayers, and voters expect and deserve a long-term care system that keeps our loved ones safe and allows them to live with the most independence possible. Older Minnesotans have been among the hardest hit by the economic downturn. We have a strong tradition in our state of caring for our elders, and Minnesotans demand that we do everything within our power to uphold that tradition. Several portions of the governor's budget proposal conflict with these important traditions. For example, we oppose the 3% cut in funding for other long-term care and continuing care providers, as such cuts could potentially lead to cut in staffing levels. And as you've heard here today, quality staff equals quality care. We also oppose the proposed cuts in eligibility for long-term care waiver programs, which help very vulnerable Minnesotans receive basic care in the community and prolong the need for expensive nursing homes. This results in cost savings to both the state and the taxpayers in the long run. We probably all agree in this room that we need to significantly reform long-term care as we try to prepare for our aging demographics. My hope is that the budget dilemma becomes an opportunity to raise awareness of the urgency of this need for reform and forces us to begin to implement some reform. We simply cannot afford to move backward at this critical time. We are working with a broad coalition to redesign the long-term care system, and these and other ideas deserve urgent attention. First, we must make it a high priority to better recognize our informal caregiving system. Unpaid family caregivers provide the vast majority of care to Minnesotans. We also have a broad system of informal support and volunteers that help support our loved ones, such as by delivering Meals on Wheels, providing respite care for family caregivers, or working as ombudsmen in nursing homes. Given the current budget and economic challenges, this system will be asked to do even more. We need to protect this fragile system from cracking. AARP supports House File 337 to provide a tax credit for low-income caregivers as one part of the solution. We also support allowing employees to earn sick time to care for loved ones, and we should also urge the employer community to recognize the needs of employees caring for their loved ones. All Minnesotans need to plan now for their own long-term care needs. Representative Thiessen's bill, which calls for a state-sponsored long-term care savings plan, should be considered. We should also publicize Minnesota's long-term care partnership program and encourage this as a tool to plan. Also, we should further advance our work to rebalance the long-term care system so that people first have the option for home and community-based funding before institutional care. Minnesota has done good work in this area, but we can do better. We should also emphasize preventative care in Medicare, and working with our federal partners to maximize federal dollars will help us reform long-term care. We hope that the dollars that will be received by the state of Minnesota, thanks to the recently passed legislation at the federal level, will help to do that. We need to connect consumers with non-biased information about their long-term care options before they face a crisis, and the Senior Linkage Line, for example, is a fabulous resource that should be better publicized and supported and protected from budget cuts. At the same time, we also need to ensure that people have access and are aware of tools such as MinnesotaHelp.info, and Minnesota's single point of entry system can help people navigate through the long-term care maze. Technology can also allow care workers to more efficiently coordinate services and can offer new care options that help keep people in their homes. We hope that committee members will keep all of this in mind as you consider the various budget options and how important all of these elements are. As you know, Madam Chair, the long-term care system is in need of systematic reform. We need to find a better way to deliver services and plan for the future and ensure quality. Significantly cutting long-term care programs today, as is proposed by the governor, would not solve our problems in the long run. It may provide a short-term solution, but there are systemic problems within the long-term care system that must be addressed. We have that opportunity today. But we should not may cut to programs that harm people and that could cause future harm or could cause additional costs to the state in the long run. So please keep that in mind as you move forward with your decisions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts today. And we will be scheduling time with each of the committee members to share our thoughts and ideas and help to sift through the proposals moving forward with the difficult tasks that you do have. We look forward to working with you to minimize the impact of this budget crisis on vulnerable Minnesotans and to try to find a way to make some long-term care reform in the midst of this dilemma. Thank you very much, and I welcome any of your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kimball, and we do have some questions, so if you would like to say an answer, we do have Representative Slawick up first. Representative Slawick, your question, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kimball, I do have a question for you about your comments on the senior linkage line.
Mm-hmm.
People in these tough times are combining resources, working together with other groups, merging, things like that. There's been some talk out there about senior linkage lines possibly being duplicative, would that be the word, of the United Way 211 line. Is there any reason these two couldn't merge, and what is the funding for senior linkage line? How much money?
I don't have the answer as far as how much funding is for the senior linkage line. I can certainly get that information to you, and we'd be happy to do that. I think cutting down on redundancy is not a bad thing. The senior linkage line, however, has been exceptionally valuable. I can tell you that our members have turned to it. We have publicized it. We have been able to drive people there. I will tell you it's very, very important for people to have one place that they can contact, that they can go to, and I think the simpler we can keep the system in that regard, the better it is. I'm not sure as far as redundancy goes if losing the senior linkage line is the way to go. If anything, I would say you could merge into the senior linkage line. That is a brand that is well known throughout the state by our seniors. And so maintaining the senior linkage line is, I think, very, very important. It's a one-stop shop that people can go. And in fact, not only for state services, but to learn information, for example, on the Medicare prescription drug benefit. That was very valuable for people to turn to and know that they could go to one place where they could get some counseling and get some advice about what would be best for them. It's a very valuable tool.
Madam Chair, and your point's well taken. I just think it's something we might want to take a look at, so if we get the funding on that.
Certainly.
Kind of how that works, and I know that
I would be happy to get that information to you.
Important, so thank you.
Kristen Catwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank all three testifiers for being here and talking on this very important topic. This question really could go to all three of you. We have talked quite a bit in this committee and in others about the need for long-term care reform. The fact that so many people are advised late in their life to sell off their assets and go on medical assistance is a pretty poor option at the end of things. And ways that we're trying in this session to try to get people to do things more upfront, everything from tax credits, increased tax credits for long-term care coverage, to tax preferred or tax favorable accounts, so that people can do some more long-term planning. Any thoughts along those lines? Are you supportive of those efforts, or are there other efforts that you would recommend to help us do more of that, get people ready for aging instead of just defaulting to Medicaid at the end of things?
Testifiers.
Ms. Kimball. I guess I will take that question. Thank you very much. I think that there is a significant amount of work that needs to be done in this regard. This is the one area, planning for long-term care, that few people do. I would challenge ask how many people in this room actually have long-term care insurance or have planned for long-term care. You don't plan for long-term care. You often enter into the long-term care system when you have a crisis. You hope that you don't have that, but it does. That is the way it tends to happen. You are lost, even to the extent that you understand the system. Someone like me, for example, or even I will say, I often use this example, Bob Payne, who's a noted professor, long-term care chair at the University of Minnesota, well-known nationally when his mother had entered the long-term care system, here is an individual who has worked on it significantly and had difficulty and confusion entering the system, especially the financing of it. I think we in Minnesota, I have always been leaders in the healthcare system. We have an opportunity here today. Even though we are in a fiscal crisis, it is an opportunity to simplify things and to improve things and to encourage consumers especially to educate. We do the best we can at AARP, but the system is itself inherently flawed, confusing, and difficult. And the biggest problem with that is financing. Mm-hmm. We absolutely need to change the way that long-term care is financing. We are changing the way that services are provided. People want to receive care in their homes and communities. Absolutely, and it is so much cheaper to the state and to the consumer to do so. But the financing of it is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Few have private long-term care insurance. Medicare pays very little of it. What is left is the state budget. So we need to change that. And one of the things that we could look at is maybe looking at private insurance and putting some structure in place and working with the industry to provide the type of product that is safe for consumers and affordable. And that might help alleviate some of the strain on the state budget. We can no longer afford to continue to rely strictly on Medicaid and the matching federal dollars with that. So that is our challenge, and hopefully we can find a solution for that. And I'm happy
Thank
to work
you.
With you.
Thank you. And we have Representative Lilly. Pardon me.
You have another
testimony? Madam Chair, and, okay, yeah.
If I may, Representative, just to build on my colleague's comments, we don't think there's any one path that provides the total solution. We think it's probably the combination of private long-term care insurance, mm-hmm. maybe a wholly new idea about a long-term care insurance trust, and certainly personal savings comes into it. And we boomers are guilty of being the generation who think of ourselves as forever young. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're the people saying 70 is the new 50. But unfortunately, we wait to plan until we actually need the care. It's something like private long-term care insurance is out of our reach. So I think, in part, it's an attitude adjustment on all of our parts. Mm-hmm.
Representative Liebling, please go ahead. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Ms. Kimball. I wanted to continue with this line of questioning, that first I have to say 70 is the new 50, and more importantly, 50 is the new 30. So since we
not even have
got that straight, I think the part of this that we don't really talk about very much is the family responsibility part. And, you know, I get all these things that we talk about helping people care for their relatives in their home. That's one piece. But not everybody can do that, obviously. And we have many people whose parents or other loved ones are on medical assistance. And I don't know how many this would be, but people who could afford to at least help with those costs if they so chose. And we never talk about that. We never talk about ways to encourage people. And I'm not suggesting here, nobody needs to send me angry mail. I'm not suggesting that we force people to pay for their parents, okay? But I think that there might have been times in history when we felt more responsible for our parents. And the idea that, I wonder if any of you, especially AARP perhaps, has thought about ways to encourage or allow people to make contributions to their loved ones who are in long-term care on the public dime, or dollar, or thousands of dollars. You know, for example, if my elderly mother was in a nursing home on medical assistance and I could afford to help, how could I do that? I mean, could I make a contribution? I know that in some facilities are such that they do fundraising for the facility and you could contribute in that way. But, I mean, is there a systematic way? Has there been any systematic attempt to encourage people to do that? Because I think we've gotten into this mentality, many of us, that if the state will do it, it's off our hands. And I think that maybe, I don't want to comment on the morality of that, but the financial aspect of it is we just can't afford that anymore. And with the age wave, we can afford it less and less as time goes on.
Ms. Kimball. There's several things I'd like to address here. First of all, it's 60, that's the new 30, and we did put that on the front of our magazine. No, but seriously, you know, it is a different age and a different time. And hearkening to your earlier comment about people taking care of their elders, I can just tell you from our own personal experience, I remember I was growing up, my grandparents lived with us. And when, as my grandfather passed away and my grandmother aged, we were able to provide home and community-based care directly for my grandmother because she stayed with us in our own home, and that was a very intergenerational thing. And that is exactly the way it was for her parents and her parents before that. We have a very mobile society now where those elders may be several states away, much less, you know, miles away and so on and so forth. We have an economic situation in this country that is so difficult that even if children want to help their elders, they may not be in an economic position to do so anymore. To that end, it might be easier to help finance long-term care for individuals, for spouses, for their children, their adult children, if there was some sort of tax credit or account such as a Roth IRA that was directed strictly for long-term care. Something along that nature might in fact encourage more people to save specifically for long-term care and may make it more affordable for folks to be able to do so, and it might assist with the planning. Is that something that AARP has promoted or has fleshed out? Absolutely not. But it is an idea that could, if it was discussed and planned for and thought out, that could work. I don't know the answer to that. Certainly, adult children now contribute to long-term care. What people want when they go into a facility is a private room, their own space, quality care. They want people to address their needs immediately, and unfortunately that's not always the case. And a lot of that has to do with the cost of the care provided.
And Ms. Kimball, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up. We do have one more testifier with you.
Yes.
That we want to get in. We have a couple of minutes left, but I hope that, does that answer your question?
Did that answer your question? Or did I get close?
Well, Madam Chair, a lot of it, some of it did, and a lot of it didn't. But, you know, I hope that we can, you know, be thinking about that. Madam Chair, just one more minute here. Mm-hmm. You know, when people go on welfare, everybody thinks, oh, what a terrible thing. You know, they're soaking the rest of us, and a lot of people feel that way. But when somebody goes on MA in a nursing home, there isn't that kind of stigma to it. And I'm certainly not suggesting there should be. But a lot, and certainly many families are in the situation you're talking about. And I, you know, I am not suggesting that there's anything, you know, we're mobile and all of that stuff. But there are a certain sector of us who could afford the help. And I'm just saying maybe there should be ways to encourage that and to suggest that if you are in that situation, it's not okay to just say, let it be the public's responsibility.
Ms. Kimball. I think many people are absolutely attempting to help and are helping if they can afford to do so. But frankly, many adult children also have children at home, and mm-hmm. so they're caring for both their parents and their children at the same time. The system is becoming increasingly unaffordable. They need help, regardless of what their incomes are. Obviously, the higher the income, the more that they're able to assist. But, frankly, long-term care is exceptionally expensive, and we do need to find ways to make it more affordable and make it a lot easier for adult children to be able to financially assist their parents in long-term care. Planning helps with that a little bit, but we absolutely have to create a structure that makes it more affordable and makes it a little bit easier for people to be able to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Kimball. Does that answer your question? All right, let's have the next testifier take a seat. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony. Sorry we don't have much time left for this part.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here with my colleagues. My name is Dawn Simonson, and I'm the director of the Metropolitan Area Agency on Aging. And my colleagues asked if I would take just a few minutes to step the committee through a high-level, at-a-glance look at our older adult services system for older Minnesotans. And so you've got two handouts in your packet. One is landscape, says Minnesota's older adult services, and a similar-looking handout that is portrait. And it specifically delineates the Federal Older Americans Act program. So if you would place those side by side, I'll spend just a moment or two here stepping you through. I think as we all understand from likely our own private experiences with our family members, our older family members, is that our system of services, publicly funded older services, services for older people is fairly complicated. And so what we've got here is the landscape picture looks at our medical assistance-based services across the continuum, both services in the community as well as nursing facility services, and looks at it from the perspective of how an older person might access those services. So if you glance at the top, you'll see that we commonly find that people learn about services, housing options, et cetera, through two sources. One is the senior linkage line operated by area agencies on aging. The other is the county long-term care consultation function. We have no wrong door to information in Minnesota, but those are two sources that people do get in-depth information about older adult services, both the medical assistance space and non-medical assistance space. Once a person is determined that they may be eligible for a medical assistance based service, then there is a process of eligibility determination, and you'll see that counties, tribal organizations, and managed care organizations have that responsibility for the assessment for program eligibility. You'll see that the assessment and determination of financial eligibility is one of counties and tribes. So a person must both meet the income and asset guidelines, and then they must meet the needs guidelines. And as you know, these are very strict eligibility guidelines based on functional and financial need. If a person is able to stay in the community, they often then, if they are eligible, they will receive services funded under the Elderly Waiver Program, as a partial federal funding matched by state funding. If their income is a little bit higher, they may receive services under the Alternative Care Program. This is a fully state-funded program. Some older people may qualify for group residential housing benefits. This is a housing, state-funded housing and food benefit program. Now, if a person's level of need is such, their functional level of need is such that they're not able to stay in the community and they qualify based on their assets and their income for medical assistance in a nursing home, then they can be admitted to a nursing home. I think if we look at the by the numbers at the bottom of the sheet, that's important. You can see the differences in care for a person on Medicaid in a nursing home. Cost of care is about $3,700 a month. Cost of care on average for a person living in the community on elderly waiver is about $1,200 a month. And if you look to see what does that mean at any given time on a monthly average, about 18,000 people on medical assistance in care centers in Minnesota on average per month, slightly more on elderly waiver, about 20,000, about 3,700 served through the alternative care program, the state-funded alternative care program. The second sheet of this handout, or perhaps it's the back side, I think there's an important data point there which indicates that according to the DHS spending forecast that we see in 2008 that the number of people receiving elderly waiver services will exceed the number of people receiving nursing facility services who receive medical assistance. So at a glance, that's the Medicaid assistance-based service system. Now, we also have an Older Americans Act, primarily federally funded Older Americans Act service system. This system...
If you could, Ms. Simmons, if you could briefly and quickly go through this, please, I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'll do that. This system is one that's operated by our State Unit on Aging, the Board on Aging, and Area Agencies on Aging. This is a program that predates the waiver programs by a couple of decades. It's the original home and community-based service program. You'll see that, again, people get their information through the linkage line, sometimes through long-term care consultation, and often as we have more and more internet-savvy seniors and family caregivers through MinnesotaHelp.info. Eligibility here is not financially based. Anyone 60 and older. In addition, the Older Americans Act program serves family caregivers, and you'll see the eligibility information there. It's important to know that these services are highly targeted towards people of low income. They're delivered in the community. They're non-medical. There's a strong volunteer component. You'll see, as an example, the types of services and the number of people served. I think the important takeaway here is that in 2008, more than 300,000 people received services through the Federal Older Americans Act program in Minnesota. The program touches the lives of older Minnesotans and their family members to a very high level across the state. Funding is, federal funding is about $12 million, state funding $2.6 million, that's primarily nutrition services. Important here to note, too, that people make contributions towards the cost of the services at about $8.4 million. And again, this is the service system that is operated by Minnesota's Aging Network, the Board on Aging, governor-appointed volunteer board staffed by the Department of Human Services, who then oversees the regional and tribal area agencies on aging, who then partner with community organizations to provide services in the community. And with that, I do have to take...
Thank you, Ms. Simmons. Are there any questions for this testifier member? Thank you very much. I appreciate your information and sharing that with us today. Now we're going to bring down the counties. We do have less than a half hour. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you to all the members of the committee. I'm Head of Superintendent Commissioner Dale Dorfman. I think I should get some vantage points for getting here.
Yeah.
And I think you might as well extend committee hearings on that, because there's only, looking around, there's only a couple of you who are going to get home tonight.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So I'm here to speak on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC, as you know, represents all 87 counties in Minnesota. And I'm joined today by Megan Marsh of MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and Julie Ring from the local public health agency. And thanks for this opportunity to give you some information about the vital role counties play in maintaining the health and safety of all Minnesotans. And we hope that the information that we give you today is useful as you address the serious budget deficit and consider proposed reductions in health and human service functions. Our presentation today is to give you a brief overview of the services that we administer to the counties, how they're funded, the crossover or ripple effect that decisions made have on other areas of county government, how clients access services, and how population-based public health happens at the local level. We provide service delivery infrastructure for the safety net. We are the safety net in the state of Minnesota. We provide direct services, or we contract with community-based agencies or collaboratives to provide the services that you authorize. People come to the county when they need housing, health care, and food, as you know. They also come to us when they suspect child abuse or elder abuse. They come to us when there's a family in crisis, a mental health crisis, a medical emergency, or a need for services for a loved one who is elderly or disabled. And right now, in this economic downturn, demand for county services is at an all-time high. For Hennepin County, the active case numbers for every public assistance program that we run has increased. Almost, and this number is a floating way, almost one in five county residents right now receive some type of public assistance in Hennepin County. And every day now, we're getting calls from people who have never used public assistance before, but due to a job loss or foreclosure, they're seeking help from the safety net for the first time, a safety net that they supported with their tax dollars. So I want to just briefly emphasize three points before I turn this over to Megan. First, if you change one part of the safety net, there's a ripple effect. Funding cuts in child care, for example, will likely result in increases in unemployment, child abuse, or homelessness. Reduced eligibility for health benefits for working in a sentence will result in increases in health care costs for treating disease and disability. I know our uncompensated care costs at Hennepin County Medical Center will go up. Reducing resources and early intervention for mental health care may well lead to more commitments to regional treatment centers and a higher cost for corrections and the courts. Second, I think it's important to remember that one size doesn't fit all. I represent the most populated of all 87 counties in Minnesota, and while access to services is important for all Minnesotans, the way we do that varies as the population's needs and resources differ from county to county. At Hennepin County Medical Center, we spend nearly $2 million annually on interpreters. That's a service that we need to ensure access to medical care in Minneapolis. Other Minnesota counties may spend more resources for transportation or other access needs that best fit their communities. Third, county officials like you are elected, and like you, we are accountable to the public for how taxpayer dollars are spent. We must balance our budget each year, and we have limited options for raising revenue, and are thus dependent upon a strong partnership with both the state and the federal government in order to deliver the safety net services that are mandated and expected. Since the last major state reduction in human service funding in 2003, Hennepin County's property tax support for human services has risen by nearly 10%. At the same time, our budget, in terms of actual dollars, has decreased by $35 million. In these trying times, we're being asked to do more with less, but the reality we face this budget year is that we'll be doing less with less. And now I'll turn it over to Megan.
One moment, please. We do have a question. Ms. Dorfman, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. How are you? Good to see you. Well, first of all, you're right on, I think, on the diversity issue among the various counties, and we've got to take that into account. But I was just wondering, on the point about the ripple effects, do you at the county level, take that into account in your budgeting process?
We
don't. But I'm just wondering how you do that.
Well, you know, we didn't used to. We used to be pretty siloed, and now there's a recognition that you've got to take that into account in terms of looking at how you provide services. Because we know that we have a housing first program that's helping get families and individuals into housing, and we used to require that they jump through all kinds of hoops before we put them into housing, and now we know they need the housing first, and then we can provide the services they need and do it in an integrated way. And so we're trying to intervene and integrate so we don't have people cycling through expensive public systems without breaking that cycle of need for them.
Representative Thiessen.
No, that's
good. Is it? All right. Next testifier, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Megan Mose, and I'm the Director of Adult Services for Ramsey County.
Can you spell the last name, please?
Sure, it's M-O-H-S. And I guess my assignment today is to talk about funding streams for human services programs and talk a little bit about the services that counties administer. So I'm going to direct you. I understand in your packet you may have a bunch of pie charts that were produced by NACSIS staff. And we'll maybe just spend a couple brief minutes going through that and then spend the bulk of our time talking about services. The first chart that I'm going to start with says at the top, human services spending total expenditures, 2005. And I'm told these numbers are derived from the legislative auditor's report that came out recently, and that 2005, in fact, is the most recent year for which complete statistics are available. So just acknowledging we're looking a couple years back.
Thank you.
And here, I think the big takeaway is we kind of divide our funding and human services programs into three main categories: healthcare, social services, and economic support. Healthcare, of course, encompasses our Minnesota healthcare programs, MAG and SRAMS, MAG and C, and Minnesota Care, which counties help administer. Social services would include a variety of things, including things like child protection, adult protection, and economic support includes many of the tax assistance programs, food support, MFIP, which you're well aware of, as well as programs like child support enforcement and group residential housing, which we just heard about a moment ago. I think the takeaway for me here on this chart is that the biggest slice of the pie is really healthcare programs. And one of my colleagues, Chuck Koenig from Swiss County, who's now retired, was fond of saying, The typical person we serve at a county welfare agency, a county human services agency, is in fact a single mom, usually two or three kids, 85 years old, and looking for nursing home placement. And I always really appreciated that statement because I think it kind of plays upon perhaps some of the stereotypes we have about who shows up as sort of the county welfare office for service. And the reality is I think the bulk of the services we provide, as it shows on this chart, is health care for elderly and disabled people and for poor kids. So with that, I'm going to move us to the next chart. Economic support is the one I'm looking at. I apologize, I don't know quite what order you have them in your packet. And here we see the biggest funding partner is the federal government, with the state next and the county third, with other resources. And I'm just, Madam Chair, going to move very quickly through these unless there's questions. I know we have limited time. I'm now looking at healthcare total expenditures in millions. And again, this is the really big one, almost $4.9 billion back in 2005. Here we see more closely a state-federal match. Of course, most of this is through the Medicaid program, where there is that 50-50 state-federal match. County match does occur in some cases. And then finally to the chart that says social services total expenditures. And here, interestingly enough, we see a larger county share in funding sort of those social services programs. And just a note on this chart, we hear a lot of talk, certainly at DHS and up here in St. Paul, about how we have 87 counties, 84 human services administrations, and perhaps 84 or 87 different ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, I think this is part of why we see that, particularly with the social service programs. We really do rely on counties as a major funding partner for those programs. Mm-hmm. And so logically it follows that we do see some variation among the 87 counties and tax base and how they're able to administer those programs. Mm-hmm. Just to finish going through your packets, so we do have some further information, a bunch of charts that look like this, but that perhaps manager members could look at in their own time, that show the kind of funding by programs with, again, those three different divisions that you have, economic support, healthcare, and social services. And then the final chart I'll draw your attention to. And again, perhaps, Madam Chair, these are just good references for members. It's kind of this rainbow-colored one.
Yes.
So that this shows county contributions by program. And really just wanted to emphasize here, Madam Chair, that the county contribution, from a financial perspective, really varies depending on what the program is as well. And you can see that there's really pretty vast variation in how much counties contribute based on the particular program. Just continuing to move forward, I think the last two handouts that you have, one that looks like this, it's printed in kind of horizontal landscape. This actually will take you through really a cataloging of all the programs that are administered by counties, both from a human services and a public health perspective. And as you can see, there are very many different things that we do, and I won't take time to go through all that today, but again, perhaps a good reference. And then finally, a kind of highly graphical one is this handout produced actually by Washington County. And really kind of the bottom line in this report just talks about how the nature of human services tends to be counter-cyclical. And it's some statistics from Washington County that talks really about how the need that they've seen or the demand for services, for food support, applications for help with lights and heat, and healthcare applications, specifically medical assistance, has really, if you follow the trend, this goes right up, just right along with the unemployment rate. So, again, for your future reading there. And I guess just the final thing that I was asked to comment on was to talk a little bit about how individuals access service at the county and what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And Ms. Simonson, who was up here earlier, was talking a little bit about the long-term care consultation process and how that works for seniors. And that, actually, that process is one that's administered by counties. And in some ways, it's very typical of the work that counties do. Typically, our role involves either, like, an intake or screening function,
mm-hmm.
some type of assessment of the person's need, whether that's done through an interview or an application process.
Mm-hmm.
And then for people who are receiving social services, we do care planning or case planning, so create a list of services that they're going to get, and then we help the person coordinate that care. And then monitor to make sure that the services are being delivered consistent with their needs, and the quality is what it needs to be. So as you can see, as counties, we play a lot of different roles in that process, both on the program eligibility and the financial eligibility side, as well as maintaining a network of services that then people access, like Homemaker, home health care, Meals on Wheels, some of the same services that Ms. Simonson was referencing earlier. So with that, Madam Chair, I think, is there questions? Thank
yes,
you, Peter.
There are questions.
Let's
we do have
okay.
questions. Thank you very much, though, for your testimony and for the charts. I think it's very good information to have on hand for us. Representative Thiessen, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just on the rainbow chart again, which actually is, you know, I think is actually interesting in terms of the maintenance of efforts discussion, just looking at where you're spending all your money. But what's children's services? What's that? What's included in that category?
Madam Chair, Representative Houston, that would include child protection and children's mental health. I believe, unless we have children's mental health broken out, we don't.
So that includes
mental health
in there as well. Okay. And Madam Chair, how much is there federal dollars for child protection? What's the federal part of that, or are there not federal dollars?
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, typically federal dollars that are available in child welfare go to pay for half of the cost of out-of-home placement. So for kids who are what's called 4E eligible, which is a very low eligibility, by the way, the federal government would pick up half the cost. Other than that, it's particularly a county and state partnership in funding child welfare, and we're one of the lowest state and federal funded states in the country's largest local contribution.
Well, and Madam Chair, that's kind of what I was wondering about, because it strikes me that the ones that are on the low end are where we have the biggest federal share, and then the state picks up another part, and then the counties don't have very much. And as we get down into things where the feds are paying less money, or where we're, like in child, is that an accurate way to kind of think through some of these charts? That the bigger the federal share, they seem to be lower in county share? And as we move down the chart, except for the MOE examples like mental health and chemical health, which is maybe a whole different issue.
Ms. Moe. Madam Chair and Representative Houston, I think of a generalization, that's probably true just as I glanced at these, that the larger the federal share, typically the less the county pays. Representative Houston.
Well, thank you. And I don't know where to go with that, except it may be, I think it's something worth thinking about. And is there a way to kind of shift? I suppose if the counties start picking up health care dollars, though, then you're going to be in even worse shape than you are today. So I don't know where else to go with that. I think it's worth thinking through, though.
It hurts my head to think that today, so we need to continue. We do have, thank you again for your testimony. And when I go to our third testifier. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Julie Ring, and I'm the director of the local public health association. And I'm here on behalf of chairperson Sherry Luer, who was not able to make it out of Waseca today, given the weather outside. I know many of you drove in, but she I think looked at the roads and looked at the weather forecast and decided it was not in her health interest to get on those roads today. In the interest of time, because I know we have 5 minutes. I'm going to refer to the handouts that I gave you, try and give you a very high-level overview of what's in them, and then I would be happy to follow up with any of you who would like more information. I've provided you with three handouts. One is one pie chart that talks about funding sources for local public health. It should be alone on a page by itself, and I will talk a little bit about that here in a minute. Another is a text-heavy piece that talks about the six areas of local public health responsibility, which is a framework for the work we do in local health departments. And then my flashier piece, I have one colored document that is the overview of the local public health system, and I would just direct you to the second page of this, where the six areas of responsibility are outlined more with less text than they are on this sheet. And then under the picture of the mom and baby eating apples, there's a list of some of the types of work we do in local health departments. Mm-hmm. I know that you were hoping for an overview of the programs we do in local health departments and how those are funded. And so just to give you a flavor of that, let's look at the pie chart for just a second, and I'll give you a sense of the overall funding for the local health system in the state. The local public health system is essentially governed by Minnesota Statute 145A, which outlines all the responsibilities for our activities. It's a broad statute, and it's a different, maybe a different focus than we're used to when we talk about social services programs. That statute outlines the partnership between state and local government and six broad areas that we work in and six statewide goals that we're working to achieve together. And those translate roughly to those six areas where we do our work. The way those things are funded overall on this pie chart, as you can see, are one-third through local tax levy. Another third on this pie chart is represented as other locally generated funds, which does include MA and Medicare, just by virtue of the way we report. And that's for some of the individual services we provide. It also includes fees that we charge on a sliding fee scale for things like immunizations and family planning services and things that an agency might provide, as well as fees that we charge facilities that we're responsible for inspecting, like restaurants and hotels and such. Two other pie charts point to federal and state funds, and those are primarily categorical grants that come with specific categorical responsibilities. In that 20% of federal funds, the largest pieces of funding are for WIC, a program I think you're familiar with, maternal and child health programming, we get a block grant from the federal government, as well as public health preparedness, which has been a hot topic of late. The 5% of other state funds are narrow categorical grants that are usually let on a competitive basis, things like youth tobacco money. Not every local health department receives those, and they're fairly directive. The last piece I want to highlight is the State General Fund Local Public Health Grant, which is a very important source of funding to local health departments. That is a block grant that you provide through general funds. It was a result of a consolidation of a number of categorical grants in 2003. During our last budget crisis, those were blocked together and cut by 30%, and cut again by a bit last year. With that, I know you're anxious to leave, so with that, instead of trying to step through all of our program areas, I'll refer you to the handouts, and I would be happy to talk to any of you more about them in the future. It is a matter of public health. She's on the road today, Representative Gottwald.
Any questions, members, for these three testifiers? Thank you so much, all of you, for coming today and taking the time to drive in, and be careful driving home. Thank you again. We are adjourned.